I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around. Go home.
One of my very first times I gave evidence was at the Old Bailey, and it was a tragic case. There was a really young 18-year-old girl. She'd never been a delinquent. She never got into trouble, never took alcohol or drugs, really studious. She became completely psychotic out of the blue and suffocated and killed her 2-year-old nephew while she was babysitting him.
Today on the show is the wonderful Dr. Shahom Das, a brilliant forensic psychiatrist whose job involves dealing with mentally ill and dangerous criminals. As well as a leading figure in British psychiatry, Dr. Das is becoming something of an online star. His YouTube channel, A Psych for Sore Minds, fast attracting subscribers, so do check that out. He creates very professional videos in which he discusses all sorts of psychiatric disorders, and he expands upon true crime stories so you can get to the bottom of why certain unsavory individuals did bad things. We talk today about what a forensic psychiatrist actually is and how it differs from a forensic psychologist such as Kerry Danes, who was on the show just a few weeks ago. We'll go into a few of the good doctor's cases and consider the differences between mental health issues and criminal behaviour and where the two coincide. When I say we, I mean Dr. Das, because I don't really know what I'm talking about, but hopefully I ask some of the right questions. Shahom assesses and rehabilitates mentally disordered offenders in prisons, courts, and secure psychiatric units such as the infamous Broadmoor Hospital. He's appeared on many TV shows and big podcasts, including this one. And outside of psychiatry, he's even done a few stand-up comedy gigs. He's currently writing a book about his most fascinating cases, due out in 2022. Find him on Twitter, that's in the show notes, with a link to A Psych for Sore Minds YouTube channel. I'm on AndrewGold_OK on socials, and find our bonus chat on patreon.com/AndrewGold or by subscribing to the VIP or bonus area on Apple. Next week, it's geneticist Catherine Page Harden on to talk about eugenics and how our genes give us advantages and disadvantages. But now, it's Dr. Shahom Das. Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks, mate. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. You look a bit beefier than I'd seen you in pictures before. Do you work out?
Yeah, I do. I try and exercise every day if I can. Do a bit of weights, do circuit class and stuff. What about you?
Oh, no. I did. I worked out for the only time in my whole life for about a month or two, about 7 years ago, because I was trying to impress my current girlfriend.
Okay, so it worked.
Yeah, well, I don't think she cares. Although it has now reached a point where there's been a few little comments because there's a bit of a tummy appearing. So I might start doing that.
Let's have a look.
My tummy?
Yeah.
I can't get it out, can I?
It's your podcast, man.
Yeah, what kind of doctor are you again?
I find that if I don't work out for like 2 or 3 days in a row, then my energy levels and my mood like really plummet. I need it. Yeah.
That's a lot of people. I think that must be, I'm reading a book, the person the week after you is a woman, Catherine Page Harden, who's written a book about genetics and eugenics from it's supposed to be a progressive look at eugenics and how we can make a fairer world from it. And I've been really obsessing a bit about DNA and stuff like that. And I'm now, I don't know if it's a cop-out, but now I'm just like, well, some people just have the genes where they enjoy exercising and I don't have it. Because you clearly enjoy it, right?
Well,
I enjoy the after effects. I think actually going through it at the time is kind of a mixture. Sometimes I'm really motivated and I'm glad I'm there. Sometimes it just feels like a slog, but I get through it anyway. But I think more than the actual act of working out, I just like a bit of peace and quiet where nobody's bothering me, nobody's asking questions, and I'm just in my own world. So I'm too impatient and distracted to meditate or anything like that. So I need to be doing something for myself.
Yeah, I'm the same with the impatience with that kind of thing as well. I got to play. The only exercise I can do is football, because at least I'm not thinking about doing the exercise. It's like I'm chasing a ball, and I'm rubbish at it, but at least I'm like, you know. By the way, so are you able to record on your side?
Yes. Do I just press the record button down here, right? That's it.
Oh, good to have that. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, actually. I'm all right, yeah. I think I'm at my happiest when I'm busy, and I'm quite busy, but not too busy. So yeah, I'm good. Yeah. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. I'm trying to work out with the microphone here, because I'm in a new setup, because I'm moving house, been moving to Bristol, was living in Berlin, and I'm in my family home, and this is my brother's bedroom, because he doesn't live anymore. And I'm putting the microphone like really close, because I want it to sound really clear, because most people listen. But then, do I look ridiculous? It's like covering half my face, isn't it?
Could you maybe shuffle over to the side a little bit and yeah. Angle it?
Thing is, like, no one watches this on YouTube. Very few people do, and loads, they're listening mostly, because I don't know. How's your YouTube channel going?
It's going all right. It's going all right. Because I'm always so busy with work, and the YouTube takes up a lot of my time. So I release two episodes a week, and it probably takes me well over a day, probably near a day and a half, just to do all the admin and stuff like that. I'm sure you can relate to that. So I am constantly asking myself whether it's worth my efforts. So I've got about 6,000 subscribers, which is okay, but it's not as high as I want to get. So I have to battle my wanting to make the videos. So I do enjoy it, versus the amount of time it's taken me versus how busy the rest of my life is. So right now it's not tipped the balance where I'm happy yet, but it's kind of gradually getting there. So not perfect yet, but.
I guess you're thinking when you're looking at that 6,000, you see it grow every day. There's a few extra, and you're just looking like, if it gets to 60,000, that's another source of really good income, right?
Yeah, well, I'm hemorrhaging money because I don't have the time or the technical capability to do stuff like social media or edit my videos. So I pay for all that. So I would be very surprised if I break even, which is fine. I'm not in it for the money. I get a decent wage from my other job. But I just want it to. I just want a platform, really, because I think I've got a lot of interesting cases to talk about. I think that my other problem, and I knew this right from the offset, is that I'm quite sort of competitive and impatient. So I know I shouldn't do this, but I look at other channels out there. And to be fair, some of them are actually very good, very good. But there's a few that I think are just not that good quality.
Yeah.
And it frustrates me that they get, you know, tens of thousands of views. And I just don't think the content's that good. So, yeah.
Man, I so relate to that feeling. Because obviously we're in totally different fields. But then I see other interviewers of my ilk who, yeah, I think like, how has he got 100,000 or 200,000 subscribers, loads of people.
So what's the answer, do you think? Why do some people in your field have that much success, do you think?
I think that some people have been going a very long time. God, my chair is so creaky. I need WD-40. It's my brother's chair. Yeah, they've been going for years. That's what everyone says, isn't it? They go for years and years and years. That's you're already getting fed up a little bit. And I get a bit fed up with YouTube. Fortunately, the audio podcast of this has sort of taken off. So I'm not yet at a point where I'm earning a living, but it's a base, which is like, okay, at least this is some way worth the effort. But then putting it on YouTube, as you say, is like, it's really time consuming, the video part and the social media stuff. And it's just like, I'm at 1,600 subscribers now on YouTube after a year. And it's like, I still watch every day and see it go up by a few. And I just think that I might as well just do the audio. But then you never know. What if in 10 years it could be getting hundreds of thousands and really taking off? So you just got to keep at it, I guess, right?
Yeah. And then what I hear, I don't know if this actually is the case or not, is that once it kind of flips into taking off and becoming successful, then people will come back and watch old episodes. So it might feel like a lot of your efforts and my efforts are wasted right now, but it's possible that people will retrospectively watch them in the future.
They better do it. They better do it. Well, you know, I'm just happy that this audio one's going well. And I get to talk to people like you. And you are a forensic psychiatrist. What does forensic mean?
So forensic is about anything to do with crime or offending. It comes from a Latin word, forensis, which I think means something like in the court or in front of the court. People, I think, mistakenly assume that it's about solving crimes. So people think that my role might involve things like criminal profiling or, you know, trying to trick murderers into confessions, but it's nothing to do with that at all. It's about rehabilitating people with severe mental illnesses who have already committed a crime. So we already know they're guilty. That's, you know, that's, there's no question about that. But it's about making them safe, rehabilitating them back to the community.
Why don't all psychiatrists get into forensic stuff? Because you'd have thought that that's the cool one, isn't it? Like, you get to deal with crime.
Yeah. So I think that the reason that... So forensics is actually quite small as a subspecialty compared to like general adult, drug and alcohol psychiatry, old age psychiatry, etc. I think there are disadvantages and maybe the things that people dislike are the things that I like about it. So one of them would be that you have quite challenging and potentially aggressive patients. So if you're an inpatient psychiatrist, if you're on a ward, like a medium secure ward, for example, and you rehabilitate these patients, a lot of them, to even be there in the first place, have a history of aggression or have like antisocial personality disorder. So you can end up being shouted at, really, and being threatened. It doesn't happen every single day, but it's certainly not unusual. Plus, I think it's fair to say that our success rate is actually quite low because our starting point of the cohort we have people with the most severe mental illnesses, the most tragic kind of backgrounds with years of abuse, physical, sexual abuse, poverty, because those are the things that give you a mental illness and those are the things that drive people to offending. So the crossroads, which is forensic psychiatry, those are our patient group. And there are exceptions, but those are the majority. So the number of people that we rehabilitate is much lower and it's done over a much longer period of time. So to give you an example, in a general adult psychiatry ward, patients are in there for maybe about a month, typically, maybe 3-4 months would be seen as the long end of the normal spectrum. Whereas in forensics, we keep patients in for roughly 2-3 years at minimum, and often more than that, sometimes even decades, because they're so dangerous. Because, you know, if we discharge them and they're not ready, then they potentially could go out and commit severe violence.
Oh, and that's a lot to deal with. And we'll get on to that. I want to know also, my understanding always of the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist is the psychiatrist is qualified to hand out drugs and things. Is that right?
Yeah. There's a few differences. That's definitely one of them. So in terms of like qualifying, so a psychiatrist such as myself is a doctor first. So you have to do all of medical school and then you have to do a minimum couple of years on medical and surgical wards. Then you specialize in psychiatry. So we've got a background in all of physical health. Where psychologists only train in psychology. And we have certain powers that psychologists don't. So prescribing, what you just said, is one of them. We can also detain people. So I can section people against their will, whereas a psychologist can't do that.
You could do that to me then if you like fell out with me. You could just pop out. Could you do that? You'd need a sufficient evidence, I suppose.
I could make evidence if I wanted to.
Oh, no, man.
I'm kidding. So it is, you need to have two independent doctors who don't work for the same trust. And a third independent senior social worker. So it's actually very hard. It's probably not.
You got no power.
Very hard to. Yeah, I've got limited power. The other thing I'd say, because I think it's important to shine some light on my psychologist colleagues, is they tend to have more time per patient, and they tend to sit down and have like long term talking therapy. So whether it's an hour a week, group therapy sessions as well, whereas we don't really have the time to do that because we have more patients.
Okay, so is there a bit? When you meet someone, so we had Kerry Danes, who's a forensic psychologist the other day. Is there sort of a bit of, when you meet someone like that, there's a bit of a power just sneakily between you and me? Is there like a bit of like, I'm the one with the power, I'm the psychiatrist? There is a bit of that, isn't there?
Well, I really like Kerry Danes. I've never contacted her in person, but I think the content she puts out is really good. So not talking about her specifically, but when you're in an inpatient environment, when you're in hospital, it's the psychiatrist that leads the team. And they are ultimately responsible for if anything goes wrong, and they're ultimately just responsible for making decisions like leave and discharge. So we delegate out the tasks, and the psychologist, as well as like nurses, occupational therapists, social workers, are one of the team. So I think the power dynamic is fairly clear cut, because it's the psychiatrist's name that goes in the section papers, goes in the discharge papers, that goes in the headlines if one of our patients goes on to, you know, kill somebody. I think it's fairly demarcated.
Does it take more studying? Are there more years to be a psychiatrist?
Yeah. So you have to qualify as a doctor first. And then after that, you have to do, to become a consultant, you have to become a member of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. So you have to do a series of exams. I think broadly speaking, there's more work. You have to go through more hoops and you have to get higher levels of qualifications to become a psychiatrist. But it's actually more competitive to become a psychologist, especially a forensic psychologist, because the NHS is just so short of psychiatrists that it's relatively easy to walk into some sort of job, whereas psychology is oversubscribed. So it's harder, it's more competitive to get into a job after you've qualified.
I think there's something tempting about becoming a psychologist. I think everyone at some point thinks I could be a therapist because you think, you know, I'm good at listening to people. Then you think, actually, it's boring listening to people. Apart from listening to us, of course. A podcaster shouldn't say that. Sorry. No, it's good listening to people. Is it true that two... I was watching one of your videos the other day on your fantastic YouTube channel. Is it true that two-thirds of murders are carried out while drunk?
Yeah, I think it's something like that. It might even be higher, actually. It's definitely around that area, 60 or 70%.
Wow. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Which is not, it's not that surprising because think about it. Alcohol can disinhibit you, right? And so I'm sure many of us have done things that we regret when we're a bit drunk. You don't really think through the consequences of your actions. So if you're somebody that's already got a beef with somebody, or if you're somebody that's naturally paranoid or aggressive, then it's just going to exacerbate those personality traits. And if you kind of, at the back of your mind, you've maybe thought about hurting somebody and then you get disinhibited, it gives you that kind of Dutch courage to go through and do it. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I don't think it's people who drink and then suddenly think they're going to go out and kill somebody. I think it's somebody that's predisposed to it. And that's like the final factor that pushes them over.
Is intoxication or drugs, are they a legal defense?
No, the vast majority of the time they're not. So voluntary intoxication is like a legal term, and that negates any potential psychiatric diagnosis. The exception is if you have like a drug-induced psychosis. So if you're just intoxicated, if you're just wasted and you go and hurt somebody or kill somebody, there's no legal defense. But if you take drugs and then become psychotic and then you act on those psychotic delusions, so if you're genuinely paranoid and you believe that somebody else is going to attack you, or you believe somebody else is going to hurt your family, and you attack them preemptively, then that could potentially be a psychiatric defense. Of course, the onus is then to prove that was your thought process. The court's not just going to take your word for it. You have to have a proper assessment.
And so are people hiring, because I know they're hiring Kerry Danes, for example, like a prosecutor or a defense team would hire her. Is that happening with you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So as well as my NHS work, which I already do in courts, I spend the rest of my time, apart from making these YouTube videos, doing expert witness work. So yeah, I get instructed, used more often by the defense, but occasionally by the Crown Prosecution Service. So they'll ask me, the most common thing I get asked is if somebody's fit to plead. So if their mental state right now is well enough that they can go through the court process, you know, understand the charges, give evidence, etc. And then less common, but arguably more interesting, is their mental state at the time of the offence. So if they've got something like a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity or diminished responsibility, which downgrades murder to manslaughter.
Do you ever feel a bit of pressure from that team to sort of give them the answer they want?
I think there is sometimes a pressure there. So some solicitors are more dodgy than others, I think it's fair to say. So sometimes I do feel a bit of a pressure. Or what will happen is their client will tell them something and the solicitors will take it at face value. So, for example, I've seen a case recently where a young man was accused of some sexual assaults. So he was trying to get the details right. He was grooming. Yeah, that's right. So there was an undercover policeman who set up an internet account on a chat room, and this man basically groomed what he thought was a young boy, propositioned him for sex, got arrested. And he told his solicitors that he has autism, and therefore he has these traits and you know, had a psychiatric defense. His solicitors took him at face value and kind of asked me to write a report that would find that. And I kind of see their angle, because they want what's best for their client, and they're not medically trained, so they wouldn't know whether he has or not. That's my job. But the way they structured the letter of instruction, their emails was almost as if it was a foregone conclusion, like, this man has autism, therefore can you conclude blah, blah, blah. As opposed to, this person might have autism or suspects he has autism.
They're doing it on purpose, aren't they? They're putting pressure on you.
Yeah. Not all solicitors like that, but yeah.
Was the guy autistic?
No. So I think he had some traits of autism. I think he was a bit sort of socially isolative. He was a bit withdrawn. he certainly had an interest of hanging out with children younger than him. So that kind of indicates that he doesn't live by normal social norms. But I don't think he was autistic. He was very high functioning. He was able to communicate with me normally, good eye contact, understood the flow of conversation. So all these things are atypical in autism.
It must be very frustrating sometimes for you because it's so hard to... I guess we want to think of, there's that book, what is it, the DSM, is it?
Yeah.
And that's changing all the time, right? So what have you got? What's happened?
That's the newest one.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah, I've not opened it yet, but you know, I tend to at some point.
Do you have to keep buying the new one?
Yeah.
How much does it cost?
Well, actually, you could also Google it as well. I just buy it because it just looks good in my shelf, and also I use it most days, so it's worth me having it. But yeah, maybe 20 quid or something.
That's a racket. Yeah. My girlfriend's a lawyer. She's always having to get like the new law book, and they publish a new one like every 6 months. It's like one word has changed and you have to get the new one. It's just such a racket.
My problem is I buy too many books. So at the time when I buy them, when I'm on Amazon. So I think, like, you know, 20 years ago when you had to actually go to a bookstore, when I was a medical student, I'd have an idea that I need this book. And then over a couple of days, I'll talk myself out of it and I can't be asked. I don't get the book. Whereas now I'm just like, I need this book. I'll buy it immediately. It'll come by the time it's come. I don't have the time or the interest. So I just accumulate all these books on criminology and psychiatry and law. And I intended to read them at the time, but it's never.
You're going to be a hoarder when you get older. That's a mental illness, isn't it? Hoarding. Is that a mental illness?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a specific diagnosis, but it is. Yeah, it certainly can be. It can be related to a mental illness, yeah.
Right. Wait, so what I was going to say about the DSM is, so, I mean, paedophilia, a lot of people think that is a mental illness, right? So just like he's saying, I have autism. I suppose he wants to say he's got autism so that he gets a lighter sentence or is sent to not a prison. Well, could he not argue, hey, I've got paedophilia. That's a mental illness.
Well, so paraphilias are, which incorporates paedophilias, are technically a mental illness, but that's not enough. So just having a mental illness in itself does not give you a psychiatric defense. So if you think about it, many people who commit crimes might be depressed to a degree. It's very common. So people who, the demographic details and the factors that cause you to commit crime, I mentioned some of them before, you know, like poverty, homelessness, abuse, just coming from a damaged kind of background, are the exact same things that drive people towards offending. So those kind of mental illnesses are very common in the offender population. So having a mental illness isn't enough. You need a forensic psychiatrist to look at the evidence and say whether you're basically in control, whether you're criminally culpable. So the insanity plea, I won't go through it all because it'll be a bit dry, but the crux of the insanity plea, which is not guilty by reason of insanity, is whether the person either knew what they were doing, whether or not they knew the nature or the quality of their act, so they knew what they're doing, or whether they knew it was wrong. So if you can prove that it wasn't one of those two things, then they have a defence. And it's actually quite hard to do that. The bar is quite high. So to go back to your example, if you said that you had paedophilia, then all that is a description of your sexual proclivities. It doesn't explain whether you knew what you were doing and whether you knew what you were doing was wrong. And I think the vast majority of people who are paedophiles would know that. There might be exceptions if, for example, they're schizophrenic and were suffering from delusions at that time, but that's a very small amount, you know, 2% of the cases I see.
Do you deal with a lot of those, a lot of child sex abuse things?
Yeah, I do. I actually, as well as criminal court cases, I also carry out civil court cases. So more often I see people, I assess plaintiffs, so people who are the victims of sexual abuse, usually from decades ago, who now are seeking compensation for many reasons. They didn't disclose it at the time. They were too young, didn't really understand what was happening. And so they now seek compensation, or they're suing the organization that should have kept them safe, like social services or a school, etc. But yeah, in terms of criminal cases, I wouldn't say it's very common, but probably I see one in every 3-4 months, I'll see a case of a childhood sexual offending. Yeah.
But you're usually working on the side of the person who, the victim?
So in the civil cases, I'm working in the side of the victim. In the criminal cases, more often than not, I'm being instructed by their solicitor. But as I said before, I very rarely find a psychiatric defense. Because the threshold is so high. The reason that I do more work for the defence rather than the prosecution is simple. It's because the prosecution only, the defence always puts their report in first. And if it's a reasonable report, so if it's been written by a decent psychiatrist who knows what they're talking about, then the majority of the time the prosecution won't challenge it. But if they think there's something that's dodgy in it, then they'll instruct their own psychiatrist. And then that's the fun bit of my job. You go to court and you battle it out and you get cross-examined by barristers and judges.
Is it a bit like the sort of TV shows, American TV shows, when you're up and you're being cross-examined by Tom Cruise and all that?
the barrister, the average barrister, is not as good looking as Tom Cruise. But it is a bit like when you're actually up there on the witness stand, it is quite fast paced and it can be quite intimidating. And the role of the barrister is to try and discredit you, right? So a barrister is never going to know more about the psychiatry of an individual than I am. But they can kind of undermine me or try and get me to contradict myself or try and make inferences, false inferences from what I'm saying. And that's standard. That's not like, somebody being hostile or being difficult.
It's their job,
literally,
right?
Well, their job, exactly. It's their job.
But do you get pissed off, though?
When it first happened, I wouldn't say I was pissed off. When it first happened, I got quite flustered and I got quite nervous. But then over time, you realise that you just have to be used to that. And all you have to do is just know your report. So I always write a report in advance. So I just have to know my report inside out, make sure I've read all the medical notes. Once I got past the hump of knowing, of accepting that I knew the case well enough, then you just have to be ready to be challenged and ready to spot when somebody's intentionally misrepresenting your words. And I've seen very experienced forensic psychiatrists get like really flustered and really angry and argumentative. That's exactly not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to very calmly and coolly say, that's not what I meant. I meant this.
That's so hard. I can so imagine. Yeah, I would get flustered. And then when you're flustered, then it's like, oh no, I've lost them now. I shouldn't have got flustered. And they get even more flustered.
Well, the thing is, right, is nobody expects an argument, right? So if I came on as a guest and I was just like intentionally twisting all your questions or all your words to me, then you would be flustered. But if you knew that I was going to do that from the beginning and you knew that you were going to speak to me for an hour and I would argue with you for that whole hour and you're prepared for it, then it's not so bad.
That's actually a reason that I tend not to challenge too much the guests that come on this show, because they're not expecting it. And it's like, I've asked them to come on and it's nice, and then suddenly it's not a nice atmosphere, is it? I don't know. Do you interview people? Do you ever have interview people on your
Yeah, I do. I've not done it for a while, actually, but I have interviewed some ex-patients. So I interviewed not of my own personal patients, but other people who have been sectioned in psychiatric hospitals. I also have interviewed a policeman called John Clark, who developed PTSD because of the experiences he had as a policeman. And he actually tried to commit suicide and then he got sectioned. And somewhat unfortunately for him, it was his own colleagues, his own police colleagues that were called out to basically stop him hanging himself. And then they had to take him to a psychiatric hospital. So obviously that was a really emotionally charged kind of scenario for him. But yeah, fascinating case.
Do you ever have that? I presume you have to look at some gruesome crime stuff and all, do you have to look at that stuff? And does that stay with you?
I occasionally get sent. So I very rarely have direct contact with victims in criminal cases. I do in civil cases, as I was saying before, but that's, decades after the sexual abuse. In criminal cases, I very rarely have contact with the victims, but I do sometimes get sent the full case papers, which might have pictures of the injury. So I've certainly seen, so you're looking through all these medical notes and witness statements, and then suddenly you turn the page and there's like pages of pictures of like these people that have been stabbed in these massive gashes. Honestly, it doesn't really affect me. I've always been a little bit, I don't know what the word is, callous, psychopathic. psychopathic. Thank you. I've never been really bothered by things as much as the average person. I don't really know why that is. It's just
we need people like you, though, because I get very I forgot the word now. What is it? What's the word?
Squeamish. The word?
Squeamish. Yeah, I get very squeamish with anything, really. I can't even like eat foods, because like meats, I stopped eating meat, not because of any sort of moralizing or anything like that. It was just like a bit yuck, and I couldn't do it. And we need people like you and people who can be surgeons as well and do those kinds of things that the rest of us just don't want to go near. So I'm grateful for that. Do you actually think you might be a bit on the sort of psychopathic scale?
I think I've definitely got some traits. I don't think I have empathy. I care about people. I've got a wife and two kids. I'm nice to them, I think. I don't lack empathy for other humans. But I'm not easily thrown by things, and things generally don't bother me. I don't know, just even recently we did a school drop off and one of the parents was complaining about, it was the first day of our kids' new school year. And one of my parents was complaining because we didn't get a reception from the new teacher at the door. And I couldn't care less. Like, I don't, things don't have to be perfect.
They're going to know about that now.
Well, hopefully they won't watch this.
Yeah, just nodding along. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Now you're coming on the podcast and bitching about them. What do you think? Maybe you've got more cognitive empathy than emotional empathy. Is that what it might be?
I mean, empathy is when you care about somebody who's gone through something horrible. And I do care. So I think I've got both. I think I'm just not... I'm able to separate what the perpetrator has done from their mental health needs. So we talked before about seeing about assessing paedophiles. I've assessed a couple of people who have killed other people. I assessed one that comes to mind is this farmer who killed his wife and then tried to kill himself, shot himself in the face, but obviously failed. Oh. And I just remember speaking to one of my colleagues very shortly afterwards, because I bumped into her on the train on the way back home. And she's a psychiatrist, not a forensic one though. And she was really freaked out by the whole situation. She'd read about his case in the paper. It was quite high profile at the time. And she just sort of asked me if I was bothered by it. Like if I was bothered by seeing him, his entire jaw was blown away and he had like reconstructive surgery and he had like basically a hole in his mouth. Couldn't speak. He had to like communicate through a tablet. God. And honestly, it didn't bother me. Like it's not like I don't care. I had a job to do. I was there to do a psychiatric assessment. His facial disfigurement, even what his pretty horrific crime, didn't bother me because I know that there's a criminal justice system separate from me that's going to deal with that. My job is only to elicit his psychopathology, potentially make a diagnosis. That's it. And outside of that, when I'm in work mode, nothing else matters to me.
I think some of those traits you're talking about are useful in a journalist as well, because you have to meet some pretty unsavory characters sometimes. And it's something that winds me up actually in journalism. There's a lot of activism, and I think people sometimes get mixed up activism and journalism. So they go for their causes and they try to put out their causes. And really, you know, I've met paedophiles and I've met like these fervent pro-lifers who scream at people getting abortions and stuff. And I sort of switch off as well in the same way. And in fact, I find it quite exciting to be in the room with somebody who's so brazenly and openly unsavory, you know. So, it could be quite fun.
Yeah. So I've seen the clips of you talking to the paedophile. He was foreign, wasn't he?
A German fella.
German, that's right. And I imagine it's similar to the way that I was thinking. Like, you might hate him as a person, and you might hate what he's done, but your the purpose of you being there at that moment isn't to judge him sitting in front of you. Your purpose is to try and extract some information and see his way of thinking. That doesn't mean that you agree with any of it. You know, I think there's something very different with judging somebody and just assessing them or analysing them. It's very different. But there's certainly been cases in the media where solicitors or barristers who have defended somebody that's done something horrific have been like, had eggs thrown at them out of them at a courtroom, or, you know, comments shouting like, how can you defend the guy? It's the same kind of thing. You're not defending them because you believe in what they did or you like them as a person. You're just trying to grease the wheels of justice to make sure that they get a fair trial. And if you believe in the court system, which is not infallible, but if you believe that generally speaking, it makes the right decisions, then you don't have to be on the side of everyone's opinion. You just have to be part of a process to allow the process to finish.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What is the link between mental illness and violence? Tell me a bit about those sort of factors in violence.
Sure. So the first thing I should say is that the vast majority of people that have a mental illness are not violent. It's far more likely to be a victim of crime if you've got a mental illness than a perpetrator. It's just the people that I see happen to be the ones that are in that very small category because I work as a forensic psychiatrist. So I think I should make that clear because I don't want to be adding to the stigma of mental illness. But in answer to your question, I think it is complicated. I think there's direct links. So, for example, if somebody is suffering from a psychosis and if they're hearing voices, the voices of the patients that I see often tell them to attack other people, or they can be suffering from delusions. So another case, one of my very first times I gave evidence was at the Old Bailey, and it was a tragic case. There was a really young 18-year-old girl, completely unblemished. So she'd never been a delinquent, she never got into trouble, never took alcohol or drugs, really studious. She became completely psychotic out of the blue and suffocated and killed her 2-year-old nephew while she was babysitting.
What? Can that just happen to anyone?
Well, this is the thing. So in her particular case, there were no factors, no markers, no mental, no family history of schizophrenia, etc. So for her, it appears to have come out of nowhere, but that's really, really rare. So for the vast majority of people that I see, they have all these risk factors that I was talking about before. Hmm. So she believed that she was ridding him of demons, and she believed that she could reincarnate him immediately afterwards. So it wasn't like a
I think I read about that.
An intentional... Possibly.
You don't know if I read about it, do you? Because you haven't been watching what I read. But was that in the papers and stuff? Or maybe I read about it through you?
So I've made an episode about it. As in all my episodes or things that I write, I always keep my patients anonymous. I wouldn't have used her name, but it was quite high profile at the time. So you might have read about it. But yeah, so that's the direct link. So when you have people that have these symptoms that make them go on and offend. So that's rare, but it does happen. So that's one obvious connection. The other connection is something that we've already talked about. So that's the demographic factors that lead to both, you know, poverty, being the victim of abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think there's other more subtle factors. So people who have mental illnesses can be vulnerable to be exploited. So I've seen at least 3 or 4 cases in my career where people who've either got a learning disability or like a chronic schizophrenia, who are quite marginalized and isolated, have been befriended by these drug dealing gangs. And these drug dealing gangs, you know, they show them a bit of camaraderie, smoke a bit of weed with them, you know, spend some time with them, pretend that they're part of the gang, and then sort of use them on county lines or use them to go out and do all the risky groundwork, and then give them, you know, they take all the money. So I think that's another link, is that, and it's probably something that's not appreciated very much, is that people are vulnerable. Because if you've got a severe mental illness and you're in and out of hospital for most of your adult life, then the chances of you having long-term gainful employment or even relationships, sometimes even family support, is quite low. So if you're marginalized and isolated, you're basically easy pickings for these kind of gangs.
Are most offenders, when I'm imagining these people in my head, they're always men. Do you come across women as well who have murdered and killed and maimed?
Yeah, absolutely. So most people that commit violence overwhelmingly are men. And there's something like, I think, 8 times the number of men than there are in women in prison at the moment. So yeah, the vast majority are men. But I worked in a female prison for a couple of years as a regular psychiatrist. And some of my medico-legal cases, definitely the minority, maybe roughly 1 in 5, I'd say, are on women. So that example I gave you before, that 18-year-old girl, was one of my major cases. So yeah, it's rarer, but women do commit violence as well.
And so what do you do then with these people? They've got a mental disorder, they've committed a crime. I mean, how do you rehabilitate them?
So there's different roles or incarnations of forensic psychiatrists. So what I've been talking about mostly so far is when I was an expert witness. So that would be giving the evidence in court about whether they need to go to hospital or prison. Once that decision has been made, then they're transferred under criminal sections of the Mental Health Act, and that's when they get into hospital. And then another forensic psychiatrist will look after their care. So the rehabilitation is, as I said before, it's usually quite lengthy and it's quite detailed, usually at least a few years. So the first thing you do is you medicate their illness. So if they've got something like schizophrenia, then you give them antipsychotics. And it's a degree of trial and error, because most drugs take about 4 to 6 weeks before they work. Depending on the severity of the mental illness, you might need to experiment or trial, I think trial is a better word, different types of medications and different doses to see which ones work. Sometimes if they don't work, you might need combinations. And if the patient doesn't have insight, which is very common, they might refuse the medications. So then you might have to physically restrain them. I mean nurses. So the psychiatrist will write the prescription, but it's the nurses that have to take the brunt of the hard work. So they might have to physically restrain them and inject them with antipsychotics, usually once every 2 weeks or once every month, which, as you can imagine, can be quite a struggle with aggressive, violent, psychotic patients. So that's the first thing. You have to medicate their mental illness. You can't really do much else until that's happened.
Why does it take 4 to 6 weeks to work? Because we're used to drugs, I guess, for lay people. It's like you take an ibuprofen and it works in about 10 minutes. So is there like a layperson answer to that question, or is it just too complex?
There is a layperson answer. So first of all, the sedative effects might work straight away. So somebody will get a bit sedated within half an hour. But the actual antipsychotic effects take longer. It's all to do with dopamine receptors. So these drugs block dopamine receptors, which takes a long time for that to happen. And it takes a long time. You have to, it has to be in your bloodstream for a long period of time for enough receptors to get blocked that actually reverses the disease.
So dopamine, from my understanding, is what sort of is, brings you happiness, like a bit like serotonin? I don't, what is that?
So they act in different parts of the brain. So dopamine, serotonin is more associated with happiness. So when you take ecstasy, for example, that's your serotonin levels massively increase, same with cocaine. And when you take antidepressants, that's the type of, that's the chemical that gets, that's its reuptake gets blocked. So the chemical levels increase over time. So dopamine also is to do with reward and happiness to a degree, but it's also to do with movement and understanding your environment. So if you've got maladaptive dopamine system, that's when you have hallucinations and delusions.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you can see a sort of chemical reason why somebody is like, and I guess a psychosis is somebody really going off and just believing totally out there stuff.
Yeah, so psychosis is like a step out of reality. Yeah.
It's hard to imagine having that. I suppose it's quite rare, is it?
It's rare. Schizophrenia is probably the most common form of psychosis. So that's a chronic psychosis where you have periods of relapsing and remitting, about 1% of the population. In prison, much, much higher, I'd say maybe somewhere between 5 to 10% from my experience.
Okay, God. I can't get my head around it because I can't imagine. I suppose the closest thing I can imagine to it is being very, very drunk and just not having your wits about you. Is that the closest
thing? I don't know whether you've ever taken any hallucinogenics, but I suppose that would be another way a non-psychotic person would have those kind
Once.
Of experiences.
It's the most miserable night of my life. I'll never do it again.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to plead the fifth on that because I'm a doctor. So.
Yeah, you can't say that stuff. I can say what I want. I don't even have a proper job. What is this? I can say, I took loads of drugs. No, it's like I did that in Colombia on a beach. Me and my friend, we thought we're going to do this, we'll do it once and try this weird type of, it was LSD mixed with something, I don't even know what it was, and it was a private beach, like a hidden beach away from everyone else and on an island, and we thought we'll just stay the night, it's so beautiful. And obviously that was the stupidest thing we could have done because we had what I suppose is, yeah, that's the closest thing to psychosis, just for hours and hours on our own hidden in a forest. It was absolutely horrible. So
what were you experiencing?
A long time of saying, I don't think it's worked. You know, I was saying, oh, this hasn't worked, you know. And my mate was going, yeah, I don't think it's worked. And like, I suddenly realized we were like 30 meters out in the sea with all our clothes on and a dog was there. It was a real dog. We weren't imagining it. And it, only looking back, it was like, you know, obviously it had been working at this point. Why were we in our clothes in the sea? So there was a lot of that. And
were you actually hallucinating? Sort of, were you seeing things that...
For a long time, I wasn't. And I think part of it was I was so scared. I'm a very nervy person, which is why this was so stupid. I'm not intrepid in any way, as though you should be as a journalist, but I'm not. And so I was so tight and like, I didn't want to let anything happen because I was so scared of it. And eventually I did reach a point about 5 hours in, at like must have been 4 or 5 in the morning, where I looked up at the sky and the clouds seemed to be forming Messi and Ronaldo, the footballers from the PlayStation cover, and I was seeing them. And then from that moment, whenever I shut my eyes, just loads of like weird Mickey Mouse cartoons and things were kicking off. And if I were able to enjoy that and not be so panic-stricken, I think that would have been a really pleasurable experience. But it was hellish because of the fear.
I think when you're taking hallucinogenics, you kind of absorb the environment and the situation that you're in. So if it's cold or it's dark or you're uncomfortable or you're not fully comfortable with your surroundings, you're not sure what's, you know, beyond, then absolutely that's going to seep in. But if you're in a warm, comfortable place with friends, then I think it's different.
It was really stupid of me and my friend Ricky. This was about 10 years ago, so I don't think he'll be listening. But okay, so let's go back. So we know about dopamine and psychosis. But what were you saying before?
So the first thing you do is you treat the psychosis with medication. The next thing is you have the psychotherapy. So this is when the team psychologist is at their most helpful. They come in and they see the needs of the patient. So it's different for individuals. It could be anger management, domestic violence, sexual offending. It could be just recognizing their symptoms. So somebody who's, for example, got mania, they become really excited, really happy, really speeded up. But because they're enjoying the experience at the time, they don't recognize it or they don't want it to stop. So part of that particular person's rehabilitation would be knowing where your limits are, knowing when you're becoming unwell. So that rehabilitation is long-term. It's, you know, 6 months minimum, sometimes a year, sometimes longer. And then when all of those things are stable, we, in our forensic units, we have like an occupational therapist. So if you discharge somebody and release them back into an environment where they have no job, no way of making money, antisocial peers, drugs and alcohol around them, then it follows that it's very likely they will at some point reoffend and relapse. So we do our best to try and set them up for the future. So our occupational therapists will either give them education, college courses, or a vocation. So in some hospitals, they can actually work in the hospital, like as a barber or the on-site cafe or voluntary work nearby. So we do our best to try and set them up for the best chance of succeeding. Then after all of those things are done, then if the patient's been stable on the ward, not been breaching boundaries, not been trying to sneak in drugs, not been fighting with staff members or other patients, then they might be ready for leave. So then we have leave initially unescorted, if that goes well. Initially escorted, if that goes well, unescorted. And if they come back on time, they don't breach boundaries, they're not coming back drunk, they're not doing things they shouldn't be doing outside on leave, then gradually, when that's been stable for a long period of time, then at that point, they're ready for release. So it's really a detailed, long process.
It's interesting what you say about sort of making them feel part of society, I suppose. And does that that actually statistically prevents reoffending?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go out into an environment where you've got a family, a safe kind of hostel, and a job, or at least a vocation and potential jobs lined up, then your chances of reoffending are much less. Yeah.
It reminds me of like when I've been looking into the paedophilia stuff, because I spent a long time looking at these guys, and the doctors there were saying that one of the biggest risk factors in whether they might offend or reoffend is stigmatization, and that if you make them feel part of society again, and that, you know, we're with you, we support you, then they're much less likely to offend.
Yeah, I think that's a logical argument, but a lot of people will have an emotional argument against that, where they don't care about a paedophile being rehabilitated. They just want them to be punished and locked away.
I know, but then it's so frustrating, isn't it? Because I always say this to people, like, that's fine. You don't have to care about the paedophile, right? That's fine. Let's forget him. But the child abuse will be curbed if we treat these people at least.
Yeah, I agree. And I think everyone deserves a second chance. I mean, there might be some exceptions if they're, you know, horrific offenders, but generally speaking, I think, I mean, I kind of feel obliged to think this, but I also separately do think this, that as a doctor, that we should set people up for at least a chance at redemption. And especially if there's a mental illness that's driving it, then they might not necessarily have had criminal culpability, or there might have been mitigating factors, which we can control. So if we can give them the right medication, if we can keep them off alcohol and drugs, then just completely taking morality out of it, just in terms of clinical risk factors, we can help decrease their chances of reoffending.
The problem is, I suppose, on an emotional and a very real level, in the very few occasions when these people are sort of let out by doctors and clinicians, and then they go on to do something horrific, it ruins lives. Has that happened in your experience and under your care?
It's not happened under my care. And I think possibly, as well as my amazing clinical acumen, it's probably because I've only been working in a hospital for about 2 years as a consultant. So before then, I was a registrar, so I didn't make the final decisions. Since becoming a consultant, which is 2014, I've only worked in a hospital for 2 years. The rest of the time has been in prison and in courts. So I'm not the one that's, you know, it's not my decision when somebody gets released from prison, obviously. But I've known it happen to other people. From recording YouTube videos, there's this one case of Dr. Canaleri, I think is her name. She's French, so I'm probably not pronouncing that right. But something like 2014, I believe it was, she actually got sued by the French courts because one of her patients went on to kill somebody else. And it caused a massive uproar at the time because her psychiatrist peers kind of had her back and said to the courts, well, if you're going to start, you know, literally charging us in criminal cases because of our patients, then we're going to have to practice really defensively. And if you want us to do that, then you're never going to get us to discharge people, and you're not going to have a system where people can be rehabilitated.
And that does happen with some in some places. I mean, that's like that Louis Theroux documentary in I can't remember what the place was called. It was a hospital in the US. People are just kept there for life with mental illnesses. Mostly it's paedophilia, but it's, I think, other sexual offenders are there just locked up for life.
Yeah.
Don't know what to do with them.
I suppose not just paedophiles, but in general, when you're talking about patients that commit violence, psychiatrists can't predict the future, right? We're not psychics. All we can do is use the information that's there in front of us. So if somebody has committed quite a serious violent offence and they go through our rehabilitation process and they're taking their medication and they're engaging and they're not getting into fights and they're sticking with the ward rules and they go on leave and they come back on time and they're not taking drugs or alcohol while they're on leave, and we know that through urine tests, etc. If they do all those things for years, then there's no justification in keeping them in longer because you're not doing anything else. You've already done all of the rehabilitation. There's nothing more you can do for them apart from test them and leave more, but there's no point. If they can do it for 2 years, then they can do it for 3 years. And a point I'm trying to make is that there's going to be a proportion of those people that will eventually reoffend, but we can't predict which ones those are going to be.
Oh, it's so hard. It's so hard. There's so much pressure on you guys as well. Do you have forensic psychiatrist friends, and do you sort of watch all the movies, like that one with Richard Gere and Edward Norton? Do you know which one that one is?
No.
What's that movie? I'm just typing it in now because I watched it and it was. It reminds me of a lot of what you're saying. Primal Fear. You should see.
Oh, Primal Fear. Yeah, no, I have seen that. I don't remember. I've got terrible memory in general, but I don't remember there being a forensic psychiatrist. Was that the guy that? Does he follow them around on a boat, or is that something else?
That might be something else. I don't know about forensic psychiatry, actually. I was just thinking about, because my next question was, that's what I'm thinking in my head, is about how you spot if someone's faking it. And spoiler alert, the end of Primal Fear, Edward Norton's character was faking being mentally ill. How do you spot if someone is faking it?
So it's actually much easier than you might think. The reason being is because most mental illnesses come on gradually over time. So if somebody sitting in front of me tells me that they're, you know, hearing voices or they're suffering from delusions, I will have already looked through their medical notes. So I'm looking at their GP notes, any previous contact with psychiatrists. I might speak to family members or work colleagues or have some of their work records. So somebody's been functioning at a normal level. If they've been going out and socializing, they're doing their job normally, and then suddenly, within the space of a couple of days, apparently has become psychotic. It's not impossible, but it's very, very unlikely, so I'm really suspicious. Mm.
The woman with the babies.
Oh, that killed her
nephew.
Her nephew, yes, yeah, yeah. So that came out of nowhere, as in there were no risk factors, but she still deteriorated over a space of time. So she wasn't violent, but she had what I would call a prodrome. So she had some very bizarre behavior for about 6 weeks beforehand. So she was, for example, she was telling her family off for watching smut on TV, but it wasn't smut. It was just what they usually watched.
Oh, that's so scary. The word smut there, I just imagine, you can see the horror film, can't you? You stop watching this smut. And then later goes, and oh my God, that's scary. Sorry, go on.
I think you should write that horror film. And she started listening to this like instrumental music and start chanting. So none of it was violent, but it was definitely a shift from her normal self. So I don't think anybody could have predicted that she would have done what she did, just to be clear. But there was something that was off about her. So when I'm assessing the patients in front of me, I'm looking for that. So that's the first thing. Second thing is I suppose we're a little bit like detectives. So I look for subtle, I kind of observe them subtly. So for example, if they're telling me that they're really scared and they're on the brink of suicide when they're sat in the room with me in court or in prison, but then I see them sort of laughing and joking with their friends when they're coming away from the visits hall, then I know there's a disparity there. And I try and get objective evidence. So if they're already remanded in prison, I will speak to the prison officers. And if they say this person's like been in their cell the entire time, they're not speaking to anybody, they're not taking food, then, you know, I could think that possibly they're psychotic. But if they say he's absolutely normal, he was, you know, talking, we were having some banter about football this morning, and that's different to what I'm seeing in front of me, then, you know, my bullshit radar is on high alert. And finally, the other thing I would say is that another reason it's quite easy to spot is because people who are genuinely mentally unwell, broadly speaking, it's quite hard to elicit those symptoms. So if, for example, you had all these paranoid beliefs about strangers wanting to hurt you or about cameras watching you, and you'd only met me for the first time, some smarmy guy in a suit, you wouldn't tell me straight away. I'd have to really sort of tease and try and get it off you. Whereas people that I see who try and fake mental illness or exaggerate it, immediately when I'm in the room, they say, I'm hearing voices, doctor, or, you know, can you see that, doctor? Or why is that person staring at me? They're too dramatic. They try too hard to convince me, I think. So it's actually quite easy.
Why do they want to fake it? Because they'll just go to a, what's the proper word for a mental home?
A medium secure unit, generally, if they've committed a serious offence, or a secure unit, yeah.
Is that much better?
That is an interesting question. So I would say if you're antisocial and you're criminogenic, so you've got a criminal lifestyle, then from my experience, prison's a better environment for you, because you're with people who you can be pally with, you might be in the same gang with. You're with people that are similar to you. If you've faked it and you've come into a psychiatric hospital, you're going to be potentially dosed up with a lot of medication. You're going to be around very ill, very psychotic people. You might struggle to have conversations with some of them. So on the rare occasion that does happen, they want to get the fuck out of there as soon as possible and back to prison.
It's no good then, did the whole faking illness thing. Man, who was the woman who was facing fraud charges who you think faked a mental illness?
So this was an interesting case. We'll call her, I won't use a real name, but we'll call her Miss Boyko. I'm in the process of writing a book, so that's what she's called in the book.
Oh, cool.
So she was a Ukrainian ex-model, and she and her cousin and a man who she had an affair with, all three of them were implicated in these carbon credit type frauds. So I'm not entirely sure how the actual fraud worked, but she basically ripped off lots of people for hundreds of thousands of pounds. And she was integral. She didn't do any of the face-to-face contact with the victims, but she would wire the money between accounts, and she set up fake accounts and set up fake IDs.
This isn't that one from the podcast. There was a BBC podcast, I think, last year, with a woman who was from somewhere like Ukraine, as in Eastern Europe, I think, who was, yeah. It was called OneCoin or something. It's not that, is it? You couldn't say if it was.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know. But, okay. I honestly don't know. But so the three of them went on trial, and then tragically her child developed cancer and got really, really unwell. So they continued the trial with the other two co-defendants who were found guilty. And then about a year later, her child got better, but she needed to be retried. And I was convinced that she was faking being too upset to participate in the trial. So she said that she was just so broken by the illness that her child went to that she was too upset. So she ignored letters from her solicitors. She wouldn't take their phone calls. And she even got her GP. She even saw a private psychiatrist. So she was actually quite rich, because she was married, very recently divorced, to a CEO of a company. So she was, you know, a millionaire living in Kensington. And she convinced, I think, a private psychiatrist to write a bit of a dodgy letter saying that she had all these diagnoses. And then she was seen by another forensic psychiatrist. And in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, she tricked this man into thinking that she was just far too unwell, far too distressed, far too depressed to actually go through the process. So she was crying in floods of tears when she saw him. Then fast forward a few months, she saw me. She's very similar in her presentation, but I just wasn't buying it. And I tried to kind of use slightly underhand tactics. So I noticed that she was able to tell me some elements of her history quite well. So she was able to tell me about her childhood, her background, you know, family history, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we talked about the crime, then she got really, really upset, like floods of tears. But then when I wouldn't let it go, when I kind of politely explained, let her cry for 10 minutes, gave her some tissues, and then said, right, so we have to talk about this. She tried it a couple of times, and I think she realized that I wasn't just going to let it go. So she became, her countenance changed very quickly. She became very passive aggressive, very irritable. And she told me that she couldn't remember very basic bits of information. So she couldn't remember if any family members had been involved in these allegations. I wasn't even asking her about her innocence or guilt. I was just asking about the court case. Couldn't remember that her cousin was involved. Couldn't remember the name of the third co-defendant who she'd had an affair with. It just didn't add up. I thought it was bullshit. So I basically politely explained in my court report that I couldn't do a full proper fitness to plead assessment because she wasn't cooperating, but I don't think it doesn't add up to me. There's no psychiatric reason, in my opinion, that she's not fit to plead. But despite everything I said, the judge still went with the other expert and dropped the case. And I think, I can't know for definite, but I think that the judge felt that he'd already got the two main culprits, and you had this, you know, quite pretty, attractive, crying woman who had a kid with cancer. So I think the judge was at least partially implicit in using mental illness as a smokescreen, I think.
I suppose it's quite sad if your kid's got cancer, isn't it? I mean, she must have been sad. Unless she was a psychopath. Maybe she didn't. I don't know.
Well, so I specifically wrote this in my report. Like, I think I even put it in bold. I said there might be humanitarian reasons for the trial to be stayed or to be stopped, but there's no psychiatric reason she's not fit to plead. So I think it's reasonable for the judge to say, we don't need to try this because it's not in the public interest. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. What I had a problem with is them using mental illness as a smokescreen of saying she's not fit to plead. That's different.
That's a really interesting difference. And I can see why that's important to you. That's your work.
It's just frustrating because why instruct me to give an opinion if you're not going to listen to my opinion?
I guess if you'd both given the same, then he'd have felt a little bit bolder, the judge.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. What about what is life like inside the padded cell, you know, and with the most violent and agitated patients?
So you're talking about a seclusion room. So I think there's that's kind of the modern day version of the antiquated idea of a padded cell. So within medium secure units, there are, and some low secure units and definitely all high secure units, there are these seclusion rooms on the side of wards. And they are for patients who are just so agitated at that time that they're a danger to be out in the ward. So what happens is they're kept in this room. It's very minimalistic. There's literally just one mattress in the corner and one sheet that's made out of this special vinyl, so it can't be ripped and can't be used to make ligatures. There's no furniture at all. And there's like a little ensuite bathroom, but all the equipment is kind of non-breakable. So it's all like steel. Like, so it's a steel mirror. So it's nothing that can be, you know, smashed or used as a weapon. And they're basically kept in there until they can calm down. Usually I'd say it's about 1 or 2 days would be normal. Exceptionally, it might be for several days or it might even be for weeks if you just can't contain their level of danger. And then what happens is you get nurses that do their observations. It's different at different hospitals, but broadly speaking, about once every 4 hours. So they go in, take their blood pressure off the patient, give them medication. And then you have to have doctor's reviews every once in a while as well. So the doctor's there to make sure there's no serious medical issue, number one, and also to decide when seclusion kind of terminates, when the patient's safe to come out. And to be fair, the majority of the times it goes relatively well. You know, people are obviously agitated, otherwise they wouldn't be in there, but most of the time they listen and they will take the medication. There's been 2 or 3 incidents in my career which are quite hair-raising where they've just been ready for a fight right from the beginning. So they just attack the staff as soon as they come into the room.
Yeah, how do you go in?
So it's actually really, really well planned and orchestrated. So first of all, you get the patient to sit right back. If the patient seems relatively calm, then you just ask them to sit down in the corner and that's it. If it looks like they might be agitated and might want to attack you, you won't open the door until they're kind of sat with their hands behind their back in the corner of the room. So that's the first thing you do. And also every nurse has a job to do and has a limb to hold if the patient kicks off. So they kind of walk in. It's a bit like a choreographed kind of synchronized swimming. So they walk in so that there's a little horseshoe around the patient and they ask the patient politely, you know, please don't move until we ask you to. And if you do move, then you might be restrained. And so if the patient looks like they're going to get up, then every nurse has a particular limb they're going for. If it's a particularly strong patient, there might be even 2 nurses for each of the legs, 1 for the arms. So they're kind of trained in control and restraint.
Are you sort of popping in there with them at that point?
So the weird thing is that we have that training, I think, because for insurance reasons, we have to be able to, the hospital has to cover their arse. So all doctors, every member of staff has the training, but the doctors never restrain. It's only ever the nurses. I think nurses have a hard job, actually. They do the worst jobs and get paid the least as well.
Yeah, that is tough. And you're like, you're there like the head of a clan, like a head of a gang, like, go on, get him and get him, boys. Man, that is scary. Do people still use straitjackets?
No. I believe there is one person who I've never seen myself, but it might just be a rumor, but I've heard that there's one person in Broadmoor Hospital who is physically restrained with like belts and chains. But that's very, very exceptionally rare. So no, we don't use straitjackets, no. We use chemicals more than, or injections and medications.
Okay, yes, of course. Last question. Are you happy doing this? Are you happy in your life? Does it make you happy helping people?
Yeah. I I don't work in a hospital anymore. I mostly now do expert witness work. The crux of my cases I find absolutely fascinating. So when I'm giving my opinion, that's the bit I love writing and love saying in court on the witness stand. To get there can be quite mundane. So sometimes I'll be sent case papers and there could be 10 or 20 pages, which is fine for me. Happy to do that, go through them. Sometimes it can be like 400 pages. That's a pain in the ass. That's like a day of just reading through medical notes and only maybe 5% of it's relevant. So I'm happy most of the time, but some once in a while, I have long, slow days.
Yeah, man, I wouldn't want to read those 400 pages and all that. And then, because the thing is, I do sometimes find, I've read a few pages and I haven't even taken it in. And for me, that's okay. But for you, you can't miss that stuff.
Well, I dictate as I read through it, so I have systems to not get too bored or fall asleep. And I have loads of coffee as well, so that helps.
That was extremely enlightening. Thank you so much, Dr. Shoham Das, for coming on the show. I'd love to have you back sometime. It was fascinating to get a real insight into a part of life that is hidden to most of us. We just sort of walk around and eat chocolate or whatever, and meanwhile, there are people being physically restrained because of their psychosis in psychiatric wards. So it's always good to be reminded of that darker side of life. Remember to check out Shoham's YouTube channel, A Psych for Sore Minds. A link is in the show notes where you'll also find links to his social media. Find the bonus interview on patreon.com/AndrewGold or on Apple subscriptions. I've not got that much to say right now as there weren't any new reviews or patrons this week. That's okay, there are always peaks and troughs, and I've still been getting such lovely messages from so many of you, so please do keep getting in touch, reviewing and spreading the word. If you're interested, I've been a guest on a few podcasts recently myself, so you can find me being interviewed about all sorts of things from exorcism to my work on pedophilia to being a documentary person. You'll find that on Chris Williamson's Modern Wisdom, Sean Atwood's YouTube channel, the Cruel Space podcast, and Eric Hunley's YouTube channel. You can find links to those videos on my YouTube channel as well, so please do subscribe there as that is growing a little slower than this audio version. Just search On the Edge with Andrew Gold on YouTube and you'll find it. You get to see what we all look like. Next up is Dr. Catherine Page Harden talking about her book, The Genetics Lottery. Some fascinating stuff about DNA and genes and all that stuff. Then it'll be astronomer Colin Stewart talking about the planets and space and time in a very easy to understand and accessible way. Even I got to grips with most of what he was saying, and I'm pretty amazed by what I learned. So that's coming up. That's everything for this episode, so I'll see you next week.